negative feeling also relinquishes the energy behind many other negative feelings, so there is a constant, across-the-board effect. For instance, a successful and well-educated man had a lifelong terrible fear of heights, an intense phobia. At the time that he learned how to utilize the mechanism of surrender, he had many pressing problems in his life. After learning how to surrender, he was busy with letting go of his feelings and fears about major life problems, and never got around to specifically working on his lifelong fear of heights. When he was later in a situation involving standing on a roof, he was amazed to discover that his fear had greatly lessened. He was delighted and went to the edge of the roof where he sat dangling his feet. He was now able to get up on ladders and go on the roof for an hour with no discomfort. This illustrates that as one fear is relinquished, all fear is diminished non-specifically. Psychotherapy aims at the amelioration of neurotic patterns. Letting go, however, is designed to undo the underlying causes of all neurotic formation. It undoes the basic structure of maladaptive feeling and behavior. Psychotherapy seeks for an improvement in neurotic balance. Letting go, however, eliminates it altogether. A limitation of most psychotherapeutic frameworks is that the therapist is constricted to what the world calls a healthy, functioning ego with all its restrictions. In this paradigm, a healthy patient is considered to be one who shares the same illusions and limitations condoned by society and the therapist. By contrast, the purpose of the mechanism of surrender is to transcend the illusions of the world and reach the ultimate truth behind it, which is self-realization, and to discover the very basis of the mind itself, the source of all thought and feeling. The goal of letting go is the elimination of the very source of all suffering and pain. This sounds radical and startling, and in fact, it is. Ultimately, all negative feelings stem from the same source. When enough negative feelings have been relinquished, that source reveals itself. When that source itself is let go of and disidentified with, the ego dissolves. The source of suffering, therefore, loses the very basis of its power. Each of us has a limit to the amount of negative feelings we have stored up. When the pressure behind an emotion has been let go, that emotion no longer occurs. For instance, if fear is constantly surrendered for a period of time, eventually it runs out. It then becomes difficult, or almost impossible, to feel further fear. It takes progressively more and more of a stimulus to elicit it. Finally, the person who has surrendered a great deal of fear actually has to search for it diligently. The energy of fear simply isn't there anymore. Anger also progressively diminishes so that even a major provocation fails to elicit it. A person with little fear or anger feels primarily love all of the time and experiences a loving acceptance of events, people, and the vicissitudes of life. The goal of surrender is transcendence. Psychotherapy accepts levels of behavior as healthy that from the viewpoint of total freedom are unacceptable. For instance, in psychotherapy, minimal fear, anger, and pride might be considered necessary or acceptable levels of functioning and perhaps even healthy. But, as we have seen, the innate destructiveness behind those lower states is ultimately not acceptable, given the power of surrender to transcend them totally. Beyond the acceptable level of functioning awaits our greater destiny, total freedom. Chapter 17. Transformation. Although letting go seems simple and easy, its ultimate effects are profoundly powerful. A quick little surrender, done in an almost off-handed manner, can sometimes bring about a major change in our life. We can picture it being similar to the wheel of a ship. if we make even a 1 degree change in the ship's compass, we will notice very little difference. But as the ship sails over the sea, hour after hour, day after day, a 1 degree change in the compass will end up taking us to a very different place, many miles from where the original course would have taken us. In this chapter, we want to look at the effect that the mechanism of surrender has on those areas of life with which most people are concerned: health, wealth, and happiness. We will discuss these areas as they are usually experienced by the majority of people, and make a contrast to the changes that will occur as the practice of letting go progresses. These changes are quite obvious when we watch the lives of others who use the technique. They will become obvious in your own life as well. Sometimes you will not be aware of them. Therefore, it is suggested that you keep a list of goals and check off the gains as they occur, so that you remain conscious and aware of the progress. This self-awareness step is to circumvent a peculiarity of the mind. When we decide on a specific technique to improve our life, and when improvement occurs, the mind has a peculiar tendency to discount the very technique that brought about the change. It is as though the mind's ego is so vain that it doesn't want to give credit where credit is due. This proclivity of mind to discount inner progress is sometimes quite comical. For instance, a man who had been stuck in the same job position for 23 years began using the technique of letting go. Within a couple of months, he suddenly jumped to the position of vice president, and by the end of the year, he was president of the company. When asked if he was pleased with himself about what he had accomplished by using the inner technique, his mind totally discounted it and ascribed his gains to shifts in business patterns. His marriage had also improved, and the mind again ascribed the improvements to external reasons. My wife's attitudes finally changed. The relationship with his son also improved, and the mind again circumvented the inner transformation and said it was due to the fact that his son was getting older. In the discussions that follow, it will be noted that the transitions from one state to a higher state are not difficult to make. They may only seem difficult to us because of current perceptions. It's important to keep in mind that as we surrender, our perceptions will change. Our goals will automatically be elevated. What now seems impossible will become old hat after we have been practicing the technique a while. We will also notice that as the mind contrasts the lower level of life with the higher level, a peculiar resistance to the description of a higher level of functioning will occur at times. The mind will get critical and try to save face by ridiculing a higher state. This is a golden opportunity, because this is the very attitude that prevents a person from reaching that higher state of life. The very process of reading this material is invaluable, for it will reveal precisely what the blocks are and exactly why these goals are impossible at the present time. As resistances, criticisms, and disparagements come up, we can begin surrendering them and letting them go right now in the process of reading about them. It is a great opportunity to identify the inner blocks to fulfillment. As Pogo said, we have identified the enemy, and it is us. As a professional psychotherapist and psychiatrist with many decades of clinical experience and training, these higher levels of functioning were considered to be impossible for most people. However, learning how the mechanism of surrender works on the practical level and watching hundreds of families, friends, patients, and ex-patients transform their lives has totally changed this view. Now, higher levels of functioning are seen to be automatic, easy to achieve, and available to everyone, often in a surprisingly short period of time. As a matter of fact, some of these levels of success and happiness will seem impossible, but the higher level will already have occurred by the time you have finished reading this book. You can tell yourself right in the beginning that these high levels of functioning are not only possible, but they are an inherent birthright. They are the natural state of which you have been deprived by all the programming that the mind has been subjected to since birth. Before reading on, it is advisable to sit quietly and make an inner decision to let go resisting higher levels of functioning. This means to make a decision to stop denying the higher levels to yourself and to make a decision to let go of all blocks to happiness, success, health, acceptance, love, and peace. By doing this, the deed is already done, for you have set the whole experience into a context that will automatically begin to unfold. Health. The average person is preoccupied with the body, its functioning, performance, appearance, and survival. The average mind is beleaguered with worries, fears of sickness, suffering, disease, and death. Therefore, the mind sets about defending the body in a great variety of ways. This leads to overattention to diet, weight, exercise, and the health of the environment. With such inner tension, by the end of the day, the average person frequently feels like a victim, drained, empty, and exhausted. One consequence of this preoccupation with the body is self-consciousness. Within the field of awareness, the body's presence is prominent, and there is a mental fixation with what it is doing, its whereabouts and movements, its survival, the attitudes and approval of other persons toward the body, its appearance and behavior. Underlying all of this concern is the unconscious equation, I am a body. This is a very limited level of consciousness. In fact, in the spiritual world, this is called being unconscious, because it is a false identification due to a marked narrowing of awareness. It is like wearing blinders. It is like having a pimple on the nose and thinking that the whole world now revolves around that pimple, and going through the day with that pimple most prominent in our mind. Be aware of how much energy is drained by this constant preoccupation with the body. Our mind has been continuously programmed with a countless variety of belief systems about the body, what it needs, what will be good for it, and its infinite number of vulnerabilities. This leads to constant preoccupations with all kinds of health preventive measures, including health food fads, the endless reading of labels for potentially poisonous ingredients, the fear of being near someone smoking a cigarette, the fear of dusts and pollens and all of the supposed contaminants of the environment. There is an obsession with offsetting all of these dangers by various countermeasures. As we have seen from previous discussions, these vulnerabilities are merely the product of the mind, and the body will react to what is held in mind. This was demonstrated in our discussion of multiple personalities, where the body reflected in each instant what that particular personality and mind believed. As we begin letting go of all these fears, canceling the belief systems and reaffirming that our true self is infinite and not subject to limitations, we move into a higher state of health, wellness, and vital energy. A helpful way to phrase it to ourselves is, I am an infinite being, not subject to blank. We put into the blank space whatever disease or substance that the mind has been programmed to see as a possible danger for us. After letting go of the endless variety of bodily fears, concerns, and belief systems, physical illnesses begin to resolve automatically. There is an increase in the feeling of aliveness and personal freedom. In the state of total surrender, the body is barely perceived at all. It is only peripherally in awareness, and there is no preoccupation with it. It functions effortlessly, smoothly, and with very little attention. A surrendered person can eat anything or go anywhere and is no longer subject to fears of contaminants, pollutants, drafts, germs, electromagnetic frequencies, carpet, smoke, dust, animal dander, poison ivy, pollen, or food dyes. Our perception of the body shifts, and it now seems to be like a puppet or a pet. This shift of perception is from "I am the body" to "I have a body." It becomes progressively obvious that the body is not experiencing itself at all. On the contrary, it is the mind that is experiencing the body. Without the mind, the body cannot be perceived at all. The arm cannot experience its armness. Only the mind can experience the armness. This, of course, is the very basis of anesthesia. When the mind is asleep, the body has no sensation. It slowly dawns on us that, in fact, the body doesn't have any sensation. Only the mind is capable of that function. This is a very important shift of consciousness, because now the preoccupation is not with the body and defending it. The focus of attention now shifts to the mind, which is where the greater power lies. As we shift our thoughts, feelings, and perceptions, we begin to notice that the body follows suit. We recognize that people are not really responding to our body at all, but to our inner attitudes, our energy state, and our level of awareness. One day it dawns on us that everyone and everything in the world are responding to our level of consciousness, our intention, and to the inner feeling we have about them. We register the magnetism of saintly people, such as Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, and Mahatma Gandhi. We see that they are beloved not because of their physical appearance, but because of the inner radiance of love and peace they emanate. The shift of focus from the physical level to the level of consciousness begins to bring rapid results. The persistent surrender of negative feelings and attitudes means that the associated guilt is also being constantly relinquished. A consciousness that is not guilt-ridden tends no longer to attract disease. In the unconscious, guilt requires punishment and sickness, with its attendant pain and suffering, as the mind's most frequent means of self-retaliation. This self-retaliation may take the form of an accident, cold, attack of the flu, arthritis, or any of the multiple diseases that the mind has invented. These diseases take epidemic forms due to television and media publicity. When a prominent figure shares with the public some serious illness, there is a sudden jump in the incidence of that illness. The unconscious grabs a hold of a disease and utilizes it to settle the score. With the constant surrender of inner guilt, there is less and less of a score to be settled. Therefore, a person who is free of negativity and guilt tends to be free of disease and suffering. The healing can be dramatic. There was the case, for example, of a magazine publisher who was in a hopeless state of advanced multiple sclerosis. The medical profession had done what it could and had given her up as a terminal, hopeless case. At that point, she came upon a technique of relinquishing guilt by studying the workbook of A Course in Miracles. In working with this home study course, which consists of contemplating exactly one short lesson a day for 365 days, she began to undo all of her guilt and resentment through the mechanism of forgiveness. By constantly forgiving and undoing the negative feelings, and therefore undoing her inner guilt, the disease of multiple sclerosis reversed itself. As of this writing, she has been recovered for years and is in radiant, glowing health, happy with her life. Health and well-being, then, are generally the automatic consequence of the letting go of guilt and other negativities, as well as the letting go of our resistance to the positive states of health and well-being. Through the surrender mechanism, the whole gamut of illnesses can be resolved into wellness. As was said earlier, there may be uncommon cases in which illness or infirmity continues unabated due to unknown factors, such as karmic proclivities. Continual surrender brings healing at the level of inner being, so that, even while the body appears to suffer limitation and others may see it as tragic. The person is at peace and radiates an inner well-being that uplifts others. Through surrender at great depth, such persons have let go of self-pity, guilt, and resistance to life's circumstances. They have transcended the view that their illness is a barrier to personal happiness and see it as a vehicle of blessing to others. In recent years, public examples of this phenomenon have included the late Pope John Paul II, who approached his unremitting Parkinson's disease as a spiritual opportunity to become one with, and even to take on, the suffering of others. Wealth. This is an important subject, not only because it has such a direct effect on our life, but also because it so quickly and easily makes obvious our feelings, thoughts, and attitudes about money. To the mind that holds limiting belief systems and negative thoughts and feelings, money is a problem. It is a source of endless worry and anxiety, hopelessness and despair, or of vanity, pride, arrogance, intolerance of others, jealousy, and envy. At its worst, the end result of all the negativity is a feeling of financial limitation, lack, and deprivation. In this area, the feeling, "I can't," due to fear and limitation, is often skirted by simply avoiding the whole issue of money and resigning oneself to a low social economic status as inevitable. The unconscious brings to us what it thinks we deserve. If our view of ourselves is small, limited, and miserly, due to accumulated guilt, then the unconscious will bring those economic conditions into our life. Our attitudes about money can be discovered when we look at the many things that it means. For example, we see the degree to which it stands for security, power, glamour, sexual attraction, successful competition, self-worth, and our value to others and the world. It is very useful to sit down with pencil and paper and, under the heading money, begin to delineate what its real meanings are in all the various avenues of life. Then, write down the feelings that are associated with each area and begin to surrender on each negative feeling and attitude. As we do this, we have the surprising discovery that money in and of itself is not the most basic issue. More important than money itself are the emotional gratifications that we hope will be ours with the use of that money. Let's say that, behind the desire for money, we discover that one of our goals is to be respected and valued. In that discovery, we have just found out that it isn't money itself that we are interested in. Rather, it is our self-respect and a feeling of inner worth. We see that money was just a tool to achieve something else, and that, as a matter of fact, it isn't money that we want at all, but the self-respect and esteem we thought it would bring us. It will also dawn on us that the goals which we thought money would bring us can be achieved directly. The higher our inner self-esteem, the less we need the approval of others. As we uncover these awarenesses, money takes on a different meaning in each area of life. Money now becomes subservient to higher goals, rather than an end unto itself. Without being conscious of what money means to us emotionally, we are at the effect of it. We are being run by our unconscious beliefs about money and all of its associated programs. It is like the millionaire who keeps piling up more and more millions. There never seems to be enough. Why is that? It is because he has never stopped to look at what money really means to him. If we obsessively chase after money or other symbols of wealth, it is because our inner self-worth is so small that it takes a huge amount of money to compensate for it. The inner insecurity is so extensive that no amount of money can overcome it. It might be said that the smaller we feel inside, the greater amount of power, money, and glamour must be accumulated in order to try and compensate for the inner smallness. When we are in a surrendered state, we are free from that inner smallness, insecurity, and low self-esteem. Then, money becomes merely a tool to achieve our goals in the world. We have an inner security, knowing that there will always be sufficient abundance. We will always get what we need when we need it, because we have an inner feeling of completion, fulfillment, and satisfaction. Money, then, becomes a source of pleasure rather than a source of anxiety. On a certain level, we may even appear to be indifferent to money. When we need it to complete a project, it just magically seems to appear from somewhere. We feel nonchalant about it, because we are connected to the source of our own power. When we re-own the power that we have given to money and see that it is our own power, we are no longer concerned about money, nor do we need to accumulate a great deal of it. Once we have the formula for gold, we don't need to carry a bag of it on our shoulder with all of its attendant worries and anxieties. The problem with excessive accumulation of money, of course, is the constant fear of losing it. It is tragicomic to watch someone who is worth $50 million practically have a nervous breakdown because through a business oversight he lost $10 million. The man was actually in a panic. Emotionally, he was frightened that he would not be able to survive on the planet with only $40 million. The person who suffers from inner poverty is relentlessly driven to accumulate on the material level. With this inner poverty, there is the whole attitude of selfishness, or its correlates, of vanity and false pride. It is very common for people who use the letting go technique suddenly to come into abundance. Struggling actors now have starring roles in Hollywood. A playwright on the edge of poverty becomes the producer of a smash Broadway hit. Paradoxically, some people have grown so nonchalant about money that they have chosen to get rid of a lot of money and live a much simpler life. They are no longer interested in money. They have mastery over it. The inner satisfactions that they had sought by means of money are now satisfied directly, so that inner happiness is independent of outer wealth. In this state of inner freedom, one is independent of the outer world and no longer at the effect of it. This is because one transcends that which one has mastered. Happiness. In the sections on health and wealth, we have already touched upon important areas relating to overall happiness. Now we will focus more on inner emotional life, because that is where we all really live. The purpose of health and wealth is, after all, merely because we presume, and to some extent it is true, that they result in happiness. Happiness can be experienced directly, however, and on this level, it is relatively independent of health or wealth. Let's take an objective look at the average view of happiness. To begin with, the happiness is extremely vulnerable. A chance remark, a critical comment, a raised eyebrow, or a car cutting into line ahead of us are all sufficient to blow the average person's happiness in an instant. The threat of a job loss, a feeling of distrust in a relationship, a foreboding remark by a doctor, or an impertinent cab driver are sufficient to ruin the day for many of us. Why is our happiness so fragile that commonplace occurrences can ruin the whole day? In the section on the anatomy of emotions, we have already looked at the reasons for this. As a result of negative feelings, thoughts, and attitudes, together with the constant judgment and criticism of other people, we often feel separated from others. Because of this feeling of inner aloneness and separation, relationships take on the form of attachments, with all the fear, anger, and jealousy that accompany any threat to those attachments. The inner negativity results in such commonly held beliefs as, you are born alone, and you die alone. Nothing, in fact, is farther from the truth. As recent books on near-death experiences reveal, it is during life that one often feels alone, and at the moment of death, there is an absolute feeling of oneness and connectedness. Edie, 1992, Neil, 2011. Because of attachments, dependencies, and inner smallness, we may feel weak and limited. The guilty intolerance of our inner thoughts and feelings are projected onto the world, making the world look like a fearful place. Because these fears are held in mind, fearful events and experiences are literally brought into our life experience. Fear results in chronic anger and makes us prone to attack and to inner emotional chaos. Pain and suffering occur, with periodic despair and proneness to emotional upset. The ego mind, which sees everyone as separate, is envious of anyone else who appears happier, more successful, or with a better relationship, a better body, or better connections. Soon, because of a lack of inner clarity about goals, there is confusion, leading to self-pity, envy, and further resentment. Self-condemnation gets endlessly projected onto the world, taking the form of condemnation from others, which increases further the guilt and feeling of smallness. For some of us, the only escape is through grandiosity, intolerance, bigotry, arrogance, and anger, which take the form of cruelty, overbearingness, brutality, and insensitivity to the feelings of others. Often, the insensitivity comes with self-excuses, such as, "I am an upfront person who speaks my mind," or, "I am the frank type. You always know where you stand with me." These comments are a cover-up for insensitivity, which might be better described as gauche. The low self-esteem results in criticism of self and others, constant competition and comparison, analyzing, contempt, intellectualization, doubt, and fantasies of revenge. When all of those mechanisms fail, there is the recurrence of apathy and feelings of hopelessness and victimization. In such a state, we become progressively alienated because there is so much of ourselves that we must hide. Our behavior leads to isolation from others and an imbalance due to overvaluation of the areas of life that do seem to work. Because of this inner chaos, the average person must of necessity stay unconscious at all times. It is interesting to watch the means that the mind has invented to accomplish this end. We watch as a person gets up in the morning and flips on the radio or the television to immediately get the mind off the self and its mental chatter. Despite the extra amusement, thoughts and feelings tend to arise until the mind becomes preoccupied with the projects of the day, work, and various schemes of accomplishment or pleasure. It starts the preoccupation with the body, all of the brushing, washing, perfuming, powdering, deodorizing, and carefully selecting the clothes for the day. The choosing of clothes brings up all the schedules of the day, its busyness with activities that have all been crowded into the day, the endless appointments, phone calls, errands, social engagements, home responsibilities, and emails. On the way to work, or the day's activities, there is the chatting with companions, listening to the car radio, making the cell phone calls, sending text messages, and reading the morning newspaper on the subway. Once at the destination, there follows the preoccupation with the external events of the day, the business, the deals, the bargains, the arrangements, the worries, the manipulations, the endless search for power, the quest for strokes, and the ever-present fear of survival. All of this is motivated by the desire to somehow derive meaning and security and to increase our self-esteem and ensure our self-worth by whatever means. The franticness of the struggle is not really realized until we are suddenly forced to discontinue it by some external event. Then we are confronted with the internal emptiness. This calls for the incessant ingestion of novels, magazines, television, and websites. Or the emptiness is avoided by the constant going to parties, escaping through drugs, numbing out with a few drinks, watching movies, and pursuing other amusements. We tend to do just about anything to avoid facing that feeling of inner emptiness. There is nothing wrong with any of these activities in and of themselves. What we want to examine is only the state of consciousness, the state of awareness, and the manner in which the activities are perceived, pursued, and experienced. In a state of inner freedom, these same events and experiences take on a totally different significance. The identical activities can stem from an inner sense of happiness, self-worth, and completeness. The same goals can be fulfilled through the realization of our inner achievement rather than competition with others. Relationships become sharing and loving rather than jealous, competitive, and driven by the seeking of strokes and approval. When we are free of negative drives, we enjoy gratifying relationships because we love people, not because we are attached to them. We can allow the other person to be free, not subject to jealousy and threat. We are not the victims of manipulation by others because we have already found an inner fulfillment. As negative thoughts, feelings, and attitudes are relinquished, we re-own the power that we had given over to the world. Much of the attraction of the world is due to the glamorization that we have projected onto it. Questions arise for self-reflection. Is it really all that money that I want, or is it the glamour that I have attached to it? What is it that I want from that job title, or from that designation of doctor, an esquire, and reverend? Is it the responsibility and activities that go along with it, or is it the glamour and esteem associated with it? Do I really love that person, or am I in love with the glamour I have projected onto him or her? The more we let go, the more we de-glamorize the world. The more it is de-glamorized, the less it runs us. We are not at the effect of glamour and can no longer be manipulated by it. We are no longer vulnerable to the professional programmers of the media and the political and social arenas. We are no longer at the effect of an inner need for approval from others. We begin to love people for what they are, not for what they can do for us. We no longer need to exploit others or try to win them over. As our own level of guilt decreases, our self-esteem expands. Relationships are now based on integrity, and we are no longer subject to emotional blackmail. As a corollary, we stop trying to blackmail others with emotional pressure. Because relationships are based on honesty, and they exist and function on a higher plane, there is no longer a fear of alienation or feeling of aloneness. The surrendered person no longer needs others for personal fulfillment, but is with them out of choice, because of love and enjoyment. Compassion for others and for their humanness transforms life and all relationships. The state of inner freedom. What does life become when one continuously surrenders? What is possible? In the surrendered state, we are independent of the outer world as a source of satisfaction, because the source of happiness has been found within us. Happiness is shared with others, so that in relationships, the surrendered person is supportive, sympathetic, encouraging, patient, and tolerant. There is an effortless appreciation of the worth and values of others, and a consideration for their feelings. Power struggles, being right, and proving our point have been relinquished. There is an automatic, non-judgmental attitude and the supporting of others to grow, learn, experience, and fulfill their own potentialities. There is an easygoing, nurturing acceptance of others. We feel relaxed, vibrant, and full of energy. Life events flow automatically and effortlessly. We no longer respond from a motive of sacrifice or giving up something for others. Instead, we see ourselves as being of loving service to others and the world. Life events are seen as opportunities rather than challenges. The personality is gentle and open, with a willingness to let go and surrender non-stop because of the unfolding and ongoing inner process of continuous revelation. As the process unfolds, we feel an inner transformation. This leads to a consistent feeling of gratitude, pleasure, and certainty about our goals. There is a living in the present rather than a preoccupation with the past or the future. There is a trusting defenselessness because the power that was projected onto the world has been re-owned. There is an inner feeling of strength and invulnerability leading to an inner serenity. At first, there is the identification, I am the body. As the mechanism of surrender continues, it becomes quite obvious that I am the mind that experiences the body, not the body. As more feelings and belief systems are surrendered, there eventually comes the awareness, I am not the mind either, but that which witnesses and experiences the mind, emotions, and body. Through inner observation, there is the realization of something that remains constant and the same, no matter what goes on in the external world or with the body, emotions, or mind. With this awareness comes a state of total freedom. The inner self has been discovered. The silent state of awareness that underlies all movement, activity, sound, feeling, and thought is discovered to be a timeless dimension of peace. Once identified with this awareness, we are no longer at the effect of the world, the body, or the mind, and with this awareness come an inner calmness, stillness, and a profound sense of inner peace. We realize that this is what we were always seeking, but didn't know it, because we had gotten lost in the maze. We had mistakenly equated ourselves with the outer phenomena of our hectic life, the body and its experiences, the obligations, the jobs, the titles, the activities, the problems, and the feelings. But now we realize that we are the timeless space in which the phenomena are happening. We are not the flickering images playing out their drama on the movie screen, but the screen itself, a non-judgmental witness of the unfolding movie of life, with no beginning and no end, infinite in its potential. These progressive realizations of our true nature prepare the ground for the ultimate realization of the identity of consciousness with divinity itself. Chapter 18, Relationships. Because they are so intimately connected with our basic desires for love and security, relationships quickly bring up our innermost feelings. For that reason, they are extremely valuable, no matter whether the relationship is classified as good or bad. In the process of emotional emancipation, everything is equally valuable. It is necessary to remind ourselves that feelings are programs, that is, they are learned responses that often have a purpose. That purpose is directly related to achieving an effect on the other person's feelings, and, by doing so, to influence their feelings toward ourselves, and to fulfill our own inner goals. We will look at common emotional reactions and examine what their real purpose is. Emotional reactions have nothing to do with love, for love is a state of oneness with another. Love is not just an emotion that comes and goes. What often passes for love, in common human understanding, is primarily attachment, dependency, and possessiveness. Negative feelings. As we shall see, all emotions toward others involve the basic belief that we are incomplete within ourselves, and therefore others are viewed and utilized as a means to an end. Although we may not be able to influence the other person in the way we would like, the utilization of the other person still occurs on the level of fantasy and expectation. We also discover that much of what we experience in a relationship is happening only in our imagination. Let's start first with the most negative emotions. We will discover what their underlying purpose is and the other person's likely response. Anger. The first feelings we will start with are the most negative, feelings of hate, malice, anger, rage, revenge, and violence. It is obvious that the underlying fantasy here is to eliminate, banish, kill, destroy, injure, hurt, frighten, and intimidate. The other person's likely response is to avoid us, to hate us in return, and to bring about a counterattack. Lesser forms of anger are criticism, criticalness, resentment, sulking, stewing, and negative judgments about others. The emotional purpose is to punish others, make them feel sorry, try to force them to change their feelings or behavior, make them suffer, get even with them, diminish and devalue them. This, of course, also results in the other person's response of counter-criticism, counter-resentment, and avoidance. To handle this area, we have to realize that almost everyone has these fantasies. Playing ostrich with them, thinking that they are wicked or that we are guilty, will not resolve them. We have to come up to the level of courage and look at our worst feelings, admit that they are part of the condition of being human, and remember that we are only held accountable for what we do with them. It is obvious that these negative feelings take an enormous emotional toll on our own inner selves. That reason alone is sufficient to warrant looking at them and letting go of them. Looking at the feelings on the level of interpersonal relationships, we now discover another law of consciousness. Our feelings and thoughts always have an effect on other persons and affect our relationships, whether these thoughts or feelings are verbalized, expressed, or not. We will not, at this point, go into the discussion of the mechanics of exactly how this comes about, but it is currently an area of research of modern advanced quantum physics, especially that area concerned with high-energy subatomic particles and their relationship to thoughts and thought forms. We can likely intuit the truth of this law of consciousness from our own experience. We generally know, for example, when someone is angry toward us, even if they say nothing about it. Sensing their repressed angry feeling, we might ask, "Is something wrong?" Even when they reply, "Oh, nothing," we are still aware of the energy of anger and upset. It is somewhat dismaying to discover the truth of this interfacing at the energetic level, but anyone can discover it by inner investigation. The overall attitudes we hold about another person are influencing that other person's feelings and attitudes about us, whether we express them or not. Women in our society are more intuitive than men. They are generally more consciously aware that their thoughts and feelings are known by others. True psychics, of course, are merely people who are experts at intuition. When first discovering the truth of this, we might go through sort of a mild paranoia. Most everyone is brought up to believe that our thoughts and feelings are private affairs and nobody else's business, that all minds are separated, and that emotions happen only within the confines of the body. As we begin to investigate this area, we find that often the set of feelings we hold about another person is mirrored back to us by their attitude, and that when we change our inner attitude about them, their attitude changes abruptly. We are unconsciously influencing others all the time because of the feelings we hold about them. As we become more intuitive, we will laugh at our former naivete. And if we research further into the world of psychics and parapsychology, we will discover that thoughts and feelings can be read by expert psychics even from the other side of the globe. The only way to get over this initial paranoia is to clean up our own act. Finding out what needs to be cleaned up is simple and easy. Just look at what you would not want others to know about you and begin to surrender it. With observation, it is quite clear that these intensely negative feelings reverberate and boomerang back to us and profoundly affect our relationships. The other person merely mirrors back what we are projecting onto them. People who carry a lot of hatred find that they are living in a hateful world and that lots of people hate them. They see external situations and the world as hateful. What they fail to see is that this entire situation is self-created. We have the secret hope that our angry feelings toward others will punish and make them suffer. Actually, we are just providing them with justification to hate us back. We have to live with the fear of their retaliation and our own unconscious guilt, which often results in physical sickness. It will be discovered that all of our anger and resentment are due to our perception, that is, to the way in which we are viewing a given situation. When the inner feelings are relinquished, the way in which we see the situation changes, and we are often surprised by the abruptness with which feelings of forgiveness suddenly arise and the relationship becomes transformed, even though on the external level we did or said nothing to express this inner change. This happens with great frequency when our intention is to overcome our resentments. A Course in Miracles is based on that precise process of changing our view of a situation by the willingness to see it differently and to be forgiving. This is what was meant by Jesus Christ when he spoke of the miraculous power of forgiveness. Interestingly enough, there is a scientific basis for Jesus Christ's admonition to bless and love our enemies. On the level of energy, the lower feelings have a lower vibration frequency and lower power. When we are in lower energy state, such as anger, hate, violence, guilt, jealousy, or any other negative feelings, we are psychically vulnerable to the other person. In contrast, forgiveness, gratitude, and loving kindness have a much higher energy vibration and much greater power. When we shift out of a lower to a higher energy pattern, we create a protective shield on the energetic level, as it were, and we can no longer be psychically vulnerable to that other person. When we are in a state of anger, for instance, we are vulnerable to the energy depletion brought about by the other person's counter-anger. Paradoxically, if we really want to affect other people, then we ought to really love them. Then, their anger at us will boomerang back upon them with no effect upon us. This was the wisdom of the Buddha's statement in the Dhammapada. Hate is not conquered by hate. Hate is conquered by love. This is an eternal law. Guilt. The next heavy area of negativity is guilt. Here, the underlying purpose is to placate, to assuage, to escape punishment by self-punishment, and to elicit forgiveness. The most important of these is the wish to elicit punishment from another person, combined with self-punishment. This is not a conscious wish. Nevertheless, it is the unconscious purpose of guilt. With a little investigation, this can easily be verified. The next time we are feeling guilty about something particular regarding another person, watch what happens in the next encounter. Almost inevitably, they will bring up the very thing we are holding in mind. For instance, if we are feeling guilty because of lateness to an appointment, that guilt will frequently elicit a critical response from the other person. By the holding of guilt, we bring on to ourselves all the criticalness of others and their belittlement of us. Our low self-esteem is channeled back to us through others in the form of their invalidation of our life. If we hold in mind that we are small and unworthy, we elicit those kinds of responses from others, whose remarks tend to indicate that we are small and unworthy. If we think we are only worth a crust of bread, then that is what we will get. This is what the scriptures mean by the statement, "The poor get poorer and the rich get richer." Poverty on any level, not just financial, comes from inner poverty, just as outer wealth comes from inner wealth. If we want others to stop being critical of us and attacking us, the answer is to begin letting go of guilt and all the feelings that have brought it about. To help clarify the role of emotions in interpersonal relationships, a very quick way of learning is to presume that the other person is conscious and aware of our inner thoughts and feelings. By doing this, we will not be far from wrong, for they are indeed intuitively aware of our thoughts and feelings, even if they are not consciously aware at a given moment. They will respond to us as if they knew our inner feelings. The overall relationship will behave as though the other person were aware of our inner feelings. If we are still holding the fantasy that other people do not know our thoughts and feelings, just notice that dogs quickly do. Do we really think that the human psyche is inferior to that of a dog? If a dog can quickly read our total inner attitude, we can be sure that the intuition of people around us is picking up the same vibration. Apathy and grief. The feelings of apathy, grief, depression, sorrow, self-pity, the blues, hopelessness, and helplessness come from the inner program of "I can't." Their purpose is to elicit sympathy, to win back, to gain support, to make others sorry, and to summon help. What is the effect of these feelings on another person? Although there may be an initial attempt to help, eventually this is replaced by pity and finally avoidance. Why avoidance? The avoidance is because of the huge energy demand that we are making on the other person. It is an attempt to drain them by throwing ourselves on their doorstep. This results in the common saying, which sounds hard-hearted, but is unfortunately so often true: when you laugh, the world laughs with you, but when you cry alone. Constant grief will drive others away. They begin to resent it unless they are in a very high place themselves and capable of effortless compassion. Chronic grief brings premature aging, a tiredness and weariness about the person, and it can only be overcome when we have the courage to allow it to come up under appropriate conditions and have the willingness to surrender to it and let it go. Fear. The feelings of fear, whether tension and anxiety, shyness, self-consciousness, caution, holding back, or distrust, have the purpose of escape from the imagined threat and to put psychological distance from the feared situation or person. Paradoxically, as we have pointed out before, because the fear is powerful, the very process of holding it in mind can make that which is feared come into our life. It is like a self-fulfilling prophecy. The energy of fear generates an inner focus on all the negative things that could happen, and that focus can coalesce the appearance of the very events that we fear the most. Fear in relationships, therefore, is giving away our power to another person and enabling them to do the very thing that is feared. The way out is to look at the worst possible scenario and look at the feelings they arouse and begin to relinquish them. Like other emotions, fear can be unraveled to its component parts, and the parts are then easily relinquished. For instance, let's say that there is fear of critical attack. We ask ourselves, what is the worst possible scenario? With this question, we see that the basis of the fear is pride. When the pride is recognized and relinquished, the fear automatically dissolves. Again, in a relationship in which we are experiencing fear, if we unravel the fear, we may find that it is really a fear of discovery of our inner anger. The fear is that the other person will retaliate against the anger. Again, when we relinquish the anger, the fear will automatically disappear. The insecure person is fearful and prone to jealousy, clinging, possessiveness, and attachment in relationships, an approach that always brings frustration. The purpose of these feelings is to bind and tightly possess the other, to achieve security by preventing loss, and, at times, to punish the other for our own fear of loss. Again, these attitudes tend to bring into manifestation the very thing that we are holding in mind. The other person, now feeling pressured by our energy of dependency and possessiveness, has an inner impulse to run for freedom, to withdraw, to detach, and do the very thing that we fear the most. These attitudes lead to constantly wanting to influence others. Because people intuitively pick up our wish to control them, their response is to resist. So the only way to bring about relinquishment of their resisting us is to let go of wanting to influence them in the first place. This means letting go of the inner fears as they come up. Pride. Feelings of pride are often condoned in our society and take the form of perfectionism, neatness, punctuality, dependability, good personhood, excessive cleanliness, workaholism, excessive ambition, success, moral superiority, and politeness. In its exacerbated forms, we see arrogance, boastfulness, vanity, smugness, and prejudice. On the spiritual level, there is the righteous killing of non-believers. The underlying emotional purpose of these feelings toward others is to win their admiration.